This is Tom Higgins, and you're listening to episode 2 of our basic criminal procedure review series. As a reminder, this is episode 2 of 7. And in this episode, we are going to talk about stop basics, and we're going to hold it to stops. Before we move into our discussion of stop basics, let's clear up two concerns. First, everything we discuss here out, this session or the remaining 5 thereafter, will be based on case law. It's important for you to be able to read cases, to know where to find cases, and for you to be able to be aware of and be intentional about following new case law as it relates to your daily work life. But it's not important for you to memorize case names, citations, or be a legal expert. In fact, you want to avoid giving legal advice to coworkers, to citizens, to your family, to anyone. Because guess what? If you do that, you're committing a crime. It's a crime in Illinois to give legal advice or legal services to someone without a law license. If you want to provide legal advice, go to law school. Graduate, pass the bar exam, get through the background and the other steps necessary to earn your law license. And once you earn your law license, you're sworn in, you're able to advise away. But let me tell you, it's a great protection. It's a big help. It's wise to avoid doing this, not just because you can't, but because it makes your life easier. When I made that transition and became a lawyer, I couldn't avoid all the people that my mother used to send to me with dumb legal questions. Cousin Eddie, relatives, people she met at the grocery store. I couldn't avoid people that asked me dumb legal questions at, you know, a social function. If I was out with my friends, wherever. I didn't have the ability to say, I can't answer that. You do. You do. So follow that expectation. Now, I realize that most of you do not have close access to department-level legal advisors, duly licensed lawyers who know the law, provide advice, answer questions, and assist law enforcement officers in navigating through specific legal questions or circumstances. But in Illinois, each of you has, at a minimum, a state's attorney for your county. Develop or use those relationships that should exist between your department or agency and the state's attorney for your county. And do the same if you have municipal counsel, if you work for a municipal department and you have in-house or you have outside counsel. Push, advocate for someone to be available to answer these questions, because you know what? If they're not available, if someone isn't helping advocate for that person, if you don't have them in-house or you don't have them easily and well accessible, they're leaving you hanging. And at the end of the day, they're going to be responsible for whatever it is that's caused by them leaving you hanging like that. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying you don't have the duty to learn the law on an ongoing basis. I'm not saying that you won't, in some instances, know the law better than some people who have a license to practice law. I'm not saying that you can't inform citizens as to the boundaries and expectations of the law. That's part and parcel to what you do. You're absolutely expected to do this. Should also have the expectation of holding your fellow officers accountable for knowing and following the law. And if we meet these expectations, we can go a long way towards keeping ourselves, our fellow officers, and the public safe, and we can do our jobs in a way that's more satisfying and productive for everyone. So just as we get in here, know that. those are the expectations. Yes, everything we're going to discuss is based on case law, and you're expected to know it. You're not expected to be a lawyer. You are expected to know the boundaries, and you're expected to abide by and work within those boundaries. So let me tell you a story. On October 31st, 1963, essentially a year and a couple weeks before I was born, while on routine foot patrol through downtown Cleveland, Ohio, police detective Martin McFadden, who at the time had 39 years of police experience, some of you may be already thinking about your retirement, but can you imagine 39 years on the job? Detective McFadden was walking his foot patrol beat, walking through downtown Cleveland, and outside of a jewelry store, he notices three men acting suspiciously. They're pacing in front of this jewelry store. He was concerned that the men were casing a job, a stick-up, that they were carrying weapons. Again, remember how long he was on the job. So, McFadden identifies himself as a police officer and asks the individuals for their names. When the men only mumbled something, is how McFadden described it, he frisked them, and he found a pistol in John Terry's overcoat pocket and a revolver in Richard Chilton's coat pocket. The third man, a Mr. Katz, was unarmed. He arrested and charged Terry and Chilton with carrying a concealed weapon. They were found guilty of that charge, and the court based that determination upon the suspicious nature of their behavior, and that McFadden's concern for his safety resulted in his decision to frisk, and that frisk was permissible. It went up on appeal. The appellate court affirmed, and then Terry appealed onward to the United States Supreme Court. Later known as the stop and frisk case, Terry versus Ohio represented the conflict between the Fourth Amendment's protection from intrusive harassing conduct by the police when no crime has been committed and the duty of a police officer to investigate suspicious behavior in order to protect the public and prevent crime. In June of 1968, the United States Supreme Court affirmed the conviction and set a precedent that allows police officers to interrogate and frisk suspicious individuals without probable cause for an arrest, providing that the officer can articulate a reasonable basis for a stop and frisk. Again, the court said it's okay as long as you can articulate a reasonable basis for a stop and frisk. To be clear, Terry doesn't provide blanket authority to interfere with an individual's right to be left alone, nor does it allow such an interference based on a police officer's hunch that a crime has occurred or is in progress. And I'll be honest with you, when I view this, and I oftentimes will read a case and almost try to see it in my mind, see the facts play out, I'm just thinking, and I guess it's part of McFadden was 39 years on the job, and he's walking this beat, and, you know, you develop a sense. You develop that instinct. And was it a hunch? At least in part? I don't know. But that's what the court said. Terry radically expanded police authority to investigate crimes where there's a reasonable basis for suspicion. But it goes back to those terms, articulate a reasonable basis for the stop and frisk. And like everything, that comes back to the facts of the circumstances you encounter, your ability to observe, see, observe, record and relate those facts and circumstances. So let's break down expectations of the law from a general encounter between the police and citizens, and that's initially what happened with the Terry case. Detective McFadden had a general encounter. Keeping in mind that we will get to the details of everything that happens after a stop in episode 4. So we're going to focus as best we can on just the stop aspects. So let's break down this general encounter and questions by the police. We need to be clear that even without suspicion of wrongdoing, a police officer can approach someone and begin a conversation without violating the Fourth Amendment, as long as the individual reasonably feels free to end the discussion and walk away. The officer has done nothing wrong. And if somebody decides to, you know, end the discussion and walk away, well, then you're at that discretion point, right? And let's face it, the most successful police officers are comfortable approaching and having conversations with people, period. They're comfortable with approaching people, with looking people in the eye, with having a conversation. They engage people and start conversations regardless of any kind of suspicion or wrongdoing. In fact, without any suspicion or wrongdoing, they don't just wait until they have a suspicion to go in and engage somebody. And because they're comfortable with approaching people, making eye contact, being intentional and practiced at how they engage individuals in conversation, these officers are typically more successful at dealing with circumstances where they have developed a suspicion of wrongdoing, and they move through the various steps we are going to discuss in this and then in episode 4. And they do that with less conflict and often better results. These officers work to implement the golden rule. They attempt to treat everyone they encounter as they would be treated themselves, as they'd like to be treated themselves, the golden rule, regardless of the circumstance. And even when the other person is being difficult. I have a person I'm thinking of who worked a good long time, actually more years than Detective McFadden. And he used to say, I go out and I try to look at and treat everyone as if they were my brother, my friend. Regardless of what they did or they're accused of doing, what I'm suspicious of them doing. That's how I try to interact with them. And I've found in my career that I get further, I have fewer conflicts, and I have more cooperation, even when someone is clearly guilty of committing the most heinous of acts. And that's, I think, probably true, right? We also want, and in fact we need, people to be comfortable and confident in approaching the police. It makes what we do easier. You've likely taken courses, and you should continue to take courses on strategies and practices that assist you in addressing this need. But the case law being our data, and body and dash cam videos being our best evidence, we know that the level of focus, effort, and consistent practices in this area support a good result or sometimes help contribute to a bad one. The ultimate test as to whether an interaction is a general encounter and a stop, or a stop, I should say, is whether the individual reasonably feels free to end the discussion and walk away. It's whether they feel, right? Reasonably feels. So let's move on to a stop where we'll flesh out that whole discussion, the reasonableness part of it. The next level of police interaction from a general encounter is the investigatory detention or a stop. A stop should be brief and only long enough for an officer to assess the situation. Brief and only enough for the officer to assess the situation, which means that, you know, you have to be ready. You have to be engaged. You have to be eyes open. You have to be taking it all in and processing, engaged to exercise your discretion in a short period of time. Okay? Think of it in those terms. In order to stop or detain someone, you have to have a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. What's reasonable suspicion? An objectively reasonable basis to suspect that the detainee is or was involved in a crime. Again, it's much more than a hunch. It's much more than distrust. This stop isn't a full-blown arrest. Rather, it's an interaction in which the citizen isn't necessarily accused of a crime, but they also aren't free to leave, at least until the officer indicates otherwise. The classic example that I always learned back in the day was, you're out on patrol. It's you're working the night shift. It's 3 a.m. It's a warm summer night. You're in a residential area, a residential neighborhood that's experienced a number of recent burglaries. And you see a man walking up a quiet residential street wearing black pants and a black long sleeve shirt. You report to dispatch, request backup, pull over to the curb and ask the man to stop walking. Depending on circumstances, your department policy, or your discretion, you wait for that backup or you exit the vehicle, but at some point you approach the man, asking his name, where he's going, where he's coming from. The man gives his name, says he's going home to an address that you recognize to be the next street down. And he reports that he's coming home from his job as a waiter at a nice restaurant you know is less than a mile or so away from your location. While the restaurant's a bit above your pay grade for weekly visits, you've been there a few times. And the wait staff, you remember, dresses just like this man. You ask the man for ID to verify his address, and he gives it to you, and it checks out. At this point, you likely tell the man, you know, be safe. You warn him about the burglaries in the neighborhood, and you ask that he call in anything suspicious. You thank him for his time. End of encounter. He goes on his way. You made the contact. Of course, you document the contact. But off he goes and off you go. Now, if the circumstances presented are a bit different, the man is hesitant or appears nervous, he doesn't provide the same type of plausible response as to where he was going and where he was coming from. No, circumstances are different, and the encounter likely moves from a stop to a frisk. And again, we're going to cover frisk in the next episode. But that's where it goes. Okay? question that always comes up is arrested or detained. And in general, if a reasonable person wouldn't feel free to leave an encounter with the police, then there are there's either been a detention or an arrest. And determining which can be tough. It's always crucial, but it can be tough, but it's fact dependent, circumstance dependent, time dependent. The facts tell the story. Sometimes it's clear when someone's under arrest, for instance, when the officer specifically says so, and then handcuffs the individual. But not all situations are that clear, because it can mean the difference between incriminating evidence being admitted or not, and a judge may have to decide. And the judge is likely to decide on factors like this. First, the scope of restraint, brief or significant. An officer's brief and cursory holding and questioning of someone is a detention under the law. An example, as noted earlier, the police officer stopping someone who's behaving suspiciously or presenting circumstances that create suspicion. The individual stopped in order to get a response of a few questions. They aren't free to leave, but they also aren't under arrest, or at least until the officer establishes or develops probable cause through that suspect's responses or actions. A vehicle being pulled over the officer pulling over a vehicle driver for some kind of traffic or equipment violation is another example. An arrest, on the other hand, involves the police taking someone into custody through a more significant restraint on movement. Now, the quintessential example involves the use of handcuffs, an advisement that the suspect's under arrest, but that doesn't necessarily need to be or go to that extent. The other factor courts are going to look at are the time, the length of the stop. Was it short or prolonged? Time is always a relevant factor in anything we do. Investigatory stops or detentions are expected to be no longer than necessary, and officers must investigate with at least the least intrusive means reasonably available. When an officer prolongs a detention beyond what is brief and cursory and broadens it, then the detention may be viewed as a de facto arrest. That is, an actual but not an official arrest. What that means is, and you have to remember, the standard is, if a reasonable person in the suspect's position would have considered the police's behavior to constitute the kind of restraint that's typical of formal arrest, then an arrest has occurred. Some courts phrase the issue as depending on whether, after brief questioning, a reasonable, innocent person would have felt free to leave. If not, there's been an arrest. But it's subjective based on that person's belief, that reasonable person. If they feel free to leave, now they're going to have to show that circumstances were reasonable. You can think of a whole list of circumstances when something's playing out and actions you may have taken in the past, where someone might believe that they were not free to leave. And it's not our charge in this class to get into all the deep weeds on this issue. But you know where those deep weeds go, especially when it comes to waiting for the canine, etc. But that's the expectation. And again, we're only focused on stops for this episode. So in closing, let's review some of the factors that the court has noted, or the courts have noted, indicate a detention may turn into an arrest. Number one, the amount of force the police used. And clearly, if you ask somebody, hey, could I get you to sit over there on the curb for a minute and then I'll get right to you, is different than grabbing the person, helping them to the curb, and asking them to stay right there. May sound subtle, but obviously different. And then we can take use of force to go much further than that. So you place them in the squad car, etc. The need for the use of force. Now, sometimes that comes back to factors of the response of the individual. But as soon as it rises to that point, then you probably cross into new territory. The number of officers involved. Not only the number, but what's their stature? What are they doing? You know what happens at a scene? I mean, are the people standing back and letting you have the conversation? Are they crowding around the individual, making it appear very much like they have no ability to move? The next factor, the manner in which officers physically handled the suspect, which coincides with force to a degree, including the use of handcuffs and putting someone in the squad car. At that point, you've crossed over that line. But then the other is the one that we've identified or extrapolated out a little bit on time, the length of the stop. The length of the stop. So time, and time, as I said, is always going to be a factor in about every aspect of the law. We're going to expand on this discussion in the next episode, where we move into frisk, vehicle stops, protective sweeps, arrest, and then we'll talk about Miranda a bit. Keep yourself safe. Reach out if you have any questions, if you need anything. Otherwise, thanks for listening. And if you need me, you know where to find me.